In the summer of 2012, I was gearing up for a move, and so I was making those kind of preparations you do to put your house on the market. So Earl, I started walking around the outside, looking at what might be broken or what needed to be painted or fixed, and that's when I found it. I'd come around the back and looked at this wall of brick on the back of the house, and running through the mortar between their bricks was this crack that started low and kind of wound its way all the way to the top. And Earl, my heart sank. The house that I was living in, it had a foundation issue about 10 years before. In fact, it had a pretty significant repair. And I began to wonder, has something happened to the foundation again? And am I going to have some kind of costly repair to get this house ready to sell? And so I contacted a structural engineer and had him come out and take a look at it. And we walked around, and he did all the kind of looking he needed to do to assess the foundation. And as we were doing that, he said this to me. He said, you know, there are only two kinds of houses in Southeast Texas where you live. Y'all know where this is going, right? He said that there are the houses that have had foundation problems like yours, and there are the houses that will have foundation problems, which made me feel a whole lot better about the whole thing. Well, he looked it over, and he said the cracks were superficial and assured me that the foundation was still stable, which was such a relief because that is such a big deal, right? Foundations are not the prettiest parts of houses. I'm a fan of Fixer Upper 2. I've watched lots of episodes of that program, but I have never seen Chip Gaines invite a client to come outside and check out that huge slab of cement underneath this house. Boy, it's just amazing. Never heard him say that. But they are vital. In fact, if there's a foundation issue and we don't take care of it, it's able to destroy all the beautiful stuff that does catch our eyes, like granite countertops and wood floors and stuff like that, which is why I was talking to a structural engineer to make sure that mine was sound. I wanted to stir your mind about that this morning because it is connected to the text we want to work today. I would invite you to the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 7. I wanted you to think about foundations because as Jesus begins to close his sermon, he's thinking about foundations too. Not the kind that go underneath houses, but the kind of foundations on which we build our lives. You see, having painted this vivid picture of kingdom citizenship, there is one more thing that Jesus wants to do with this sermon, a critical decision to which he wants to call us. And to help us see it, he uses this beautiful story right at the end of the sermon. Maybe one of the most familiar of Jesus' parables, probably due in part to the really cool gestures that go along with a kid's song. I thought maybe we could sing it rather than read it this morning, and I changed my mind about that. I don't want to do that. Let's read it together. I'm in Matthew 7. Look down at verse 24. Here is the parable. Jesus says, therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock, and the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against that house, and yet it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. But he continues, verse 26, everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a fool who built his house on the sand. The rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. What I'd like to do today is invite you to look with me at three pieces of this story that Jesus uses and notice how they work together to call us to this last great decision that he wants us to see here at the end of this great sermon. So let's spend some time thinking about the parable of the two builders, and let's focus first right there. Let's focus on the two builders, because that is what the story is about. Two men who undertake to do what men in every place and every time, everywhere in the world, at times do. They're building houses. They're building a place for them to live. That's what the story is about. And it is what our story is about. Like the men in the story, we are building too. Jesus wants us to find ourselves in these two men. All of us, like them, all of us build. We've been allotted by God a measure of time and material and opportunity. Now, to be sure, we don't all get the same amount. We don't all get the same quality of materials. But all of us, every one of us, we get something that we're supposed to work with. We all build. But like the men in the story, we don't build the same way, do we? Some people are kind of haphazard about their building. You know people like this. They just sort of slide through every day just trying to get to the weekend. And along the way, they squander opportunities and resources and generally spend their lives exasperating their parents, right? And then we all know people who are just exactly the opposite of that. They are goal-oriented and focused and intentional, and they are determined to take whatever it is that God has given to them and trusted to them and to absolutely make the most out of their life. They're the kind of people you do not want to go on vacation with because they have already prepared a spreadsheet. They've got every hour of every day planned out, right? And the rest of us, well, we're just scattered between those two extremes. But we're all just like the men in the story. We're all building. And the Lord weighs in on the project. Understand that he has something in mind for these resources that he has committed to us. He wants us to do something with it. In fact, it seems to me that's kind of what the Sermon on the Mount is all about. What it is that God wants us to do with what he's given us. How the Lord wants us to build. And so as he begins to conclude the sermon, there is this last thing, this one crucial decision that needs to be made, and to help us see that, he will focus our attention in this story on one particular part of the building, which brings us to the second piece I wanted you to think with me about, and that is the foundation. Because that's really where we're made to think in the story, about the foundation, and it's where our two builders part company, right? The first guy, we're told, he sets his foundation on the rock. In fact, I like Luke's telling of it even better. In Luke 6 and verse 48, it says that he dug deep and laid his foundation on the rock. I can almost feel the perspiration beating up on his forehead when I think about this guy digging down into the dirt, trying to find that ledge of rock where he could lay that foundation. It is a lot of effort for a part of the house that is largely unseen, right? Yeah, we get it. We know why he's doing that. He's trying to get out to something solid, because if he can get out some rock and put his foundation here, his house is going to be rock solid. That's why he's doing that. The other guy didn't do that at all. In fact, it would seem, at least on the surface, that he makes a better choice, an easier choice. He builds his house on the sand. My guess is that took a lot less time, don't you? In fact, I can sort of see him on the porch in a rocker watching his neighbor finish up, because this guy got done earlier. And maybe when they were both finished, you could look at the houses and they look the same. Now, time is going to tell a different story, and we'll get to that. But before we do, we need to find ourselves here in this part of the story. Like the men in Jesus' parable, we all, as we build life, we build on a foundation. We choose a foundation. In fact, it seems to me that is the decision here at the end that he's trying to get us to see. He wants us to build on the right one. which then raises the critical question of the whole thing. What is the right foundation on which a person can build their life? What is it? And what I love about the parable is it's just so amazingly simple, isn't it? Look back at verse number 24. Notice what he says there. In verse 24, he said, it is the man who hears these words of mine, here it is, here's the key, and acts on them. That is the man that is building on a solid foundation. That is the man who's building a life that will endure. And then by contrast, at 26, he looks at the guy that builds on the sand, and what does he say? This is the man who hears the words of Jesus and does not act on them. He said, that's the man, that man's the fool, because his house will not stand. You know what I love about that? Jesus makes life amazingly easy. He says, in essence, it all boils down to one simple choice. Either we listen to him or we do not. Either we obey him, we act on what he says, or we do not. Those are the only options, and all men choose one or the other. That's the last critical decision of this sermon. They've heard what Jesus said. What are you going to do with it? And it is the decision that confronts all of us in our building. We've heard what he said. What are we going to do with it? It is not a new idea, actually, in the sermon. In fact, if you back up a little bit, what you'll find is that Jesus has already been working this idea for a while. So I'm going back to verse 13. Will you back up with me there? I want you to notice with me this morning that before he talks about the two foundations, Jesus first talked about the two paths. Do you remember that from earlier in the sermon? In Matthew 7 and verse 13, where the Lord said, enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that lead to destruction, and there are many who enter through it, for the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and there are few who find it. So at the end, there are two foundations. But notice, before that, there were two paths, and they're kind of like the foundations. One of the paths sounds easier to travel than the other, doesn't it? If you look at verse 13, Jesus said, the way to get on this way, it's wide, and the path, it's broad. One writer described it this way, and I like this. He said, it is the road of tolerance and permissiveness. And he added, it doesn't have any curbs or boundaries of thought or conduct. You know why people want to go this way? Because they can do as they please. And the fact that lots of other people travel this way too only adds to this feeling that this is the right way to go. This is how we should go, how we should go through life. But now look at 14. Because the other path isn't like that at all, is it? Jesus said the gate to get on this road, it's small. And the way to travel, it's narrow. It's like the foundations. You get the sense that this is just a harder way to go. Those who travel this path allow God to set boundaries and place limits. And then they discipline themselves to respect those limits. That's why other people don't want to go this way. It's just a life with rules. And I don't want to follow any rules. And not having to follow rules seems like such a better, certainly a more fun way to go through life, isn't it? That's what the world believes. And sometimes we do too. The problem is that people who see it this way just don't look far enough down the road. You know what problem with the Broadway folks? Inevitably, there are potholes in that road. Grief and pain and suffering are never far behind the choice to sin. Oh, it may look good in the moment, but you map that out a while, that Broadway is never an easier way to go. I think that's one reason that people who travel the narrow way ultimately over time are happier with their choice. They avoid the pain and grief that go along with the choice to sin. But it's not the more important reason to go that way. One more thing. Look at verses 13 and 14 again. You notice that Jesus says both paths have a destination. That broad way is going somewhere. He says it's leading to destruction. The narrow way, it's leading to life. That's the only way to go in life. Either you're traveling the broad way to hell or you're traveling the narrow way to life with God in heaven. The only options. It's odd that our mixed up world has found a way to embrace heaven. Statistically, everyone believes in heaven. And reject the idea of hell. Almost nobody believes in the biblical concept of hell. But brothers and sisters, you can't believe Jesus and take that approach to life. Because he's teaching about both of them and he's doing it right here. There are not many paths to go in life, many ways to go that ultimately all end up in the same place. The Lord said there are two paths and they have very different destinations. We're going one way or the other. To be brutal about this, brothers and sisters, it's either the path going to heaven or it is the path going to hell. Those are the only options. And please know that I know when I say that, that narrow view of life will be offensive to folks in our culture. But understand the fact that people are offended by it doesn't make it any less true. And so the Lord gives us this impassioned appeal in verse 13. Enter by the narrow gate. Everything is riding on this choice. And so we choose the broad way or the narrow way. We choose a foundation, sand or rock. He's calling us to make a decision about how we're going to go. But we can't leave off what comes next. Look at verse 15. Because our efforts to do that, to travel the narrow way, are going to be complicated by the presence of false teachers. And so in verse 15, Jesus warns, beware of the false prophets. As we try to figure out which way to go, they muddy the waters. They confuse us about how to get on the narrow way. And then once we're there, they confuse us about just how restrictive it really is. And some of them say, quit worrying about the way. All paths lead to God anyway. And so what does the Lord say about that? Beware of the false prophets. We need to be very careful about the teachers we choose to hear and the teaching we choose to embrace. There are some important assumptions, I think, that underlie that admonition. First, that admonition assumes that false teachers are a real thing. You know, Jeff, I'm stunned at some of the things I feel like I need to get up and say when I preach. I couldn't imagine 30 years ago when I first started preaching needing to say to an audience, y'all know there really are false teachers? And yet, you know, in which the time in which we're living, it's necessary to get up and say that false teachers are a real thing. Yeah, there are people out there that teach us what Jesus said and help us stay on the narrow way, but those are not the only teachers. They're not the only voices. There are other voices out there that are tugging us in the wrong direction, even in the name of Jesus. It's not a new problem. Jeremiah told his audience a long time ago in Jeremiah 27, verse 9, do not listen to your prophets, for they prophesy a lie to you. Galatians chapter 1 and verse 6, Paul warned these churches in the New Testament that there were some trying to distort the gospel. You and I need to be very careful about the teachers we choose to hear and the messages we choose to embrace. False teachers are a real thing. The second assumption that underlies that warning is that we can know the difference. Do you see that? If the Lord says to me, beware of the false teachers, in other words, be warned, stay away from that, it necessarily implies that you and I have a way of distinguishing between the true and the false, and that's true. Jesus claimed to be the source of truth, the only way to the Father. And so he becomes the objective ground by which everything else we hear is measured. The message agrees with Jesus, it is true. If it's in conflict with what Jesus said, it is false. This idea that truth is subjective, that what may be true for you may not be true for me. Brothers and sisters, can I be plain about that? That is a lie from the devil trying to make us feel good about being on the wrong path. We can know what is true, and we must. Because as Jesus makes clear in this context, everything is at stake. Go back to verse 13. There is destruction at the end of the broad path. Look down at verse 23. Notice that when the Lord comes, verse 23 says, some, even very religious people, will be told to depart. Verse 21 says, only those who do the will of the Father enter the kingdom of heaven. It matters who we hear. So what do we have? The latter part of this chapter, as Jesus begins to wrap up this sermon, I think what we have is Jesus essentially calling all of us to make the same decision. He's just doing it in three different ways. First of all, there's a path to be chosen, the broad way or the narrow way. And then in verse 15, he picks up this idea of different teachers. Who are we going to hear? The one who speaks truth or the one who speaks falsely? And finally, we get to the end of the parable and we have the two foundations. Do we build on rock or do we build on sand? But ultimately, they're all driving at the same thing. Jesus is saying, will you hear me? Will you take my words and act on them? Doing that is vital if we are to be ready for the storm. And so that's the third piece I want you to see with me this morning. Let's talk a little bit about the storms. Because foundations are not the only thing that homeowners in Southeast Texas have to concern themselves with, right? The late summer months, the simmering waters of the Gulf of Mexico can stir up a storm. We know that all too well. And so one of those ugly big Cat 5 hurricanes rolling right our way with all that wind and rain and flooding. And yeah, I know what you're thinking. Please don't even go there. Don't want to think about that. Harvey comes to mind, right? You know what a storm like that will do? Like the parable, it will test the house, won't it? And I'm talking to an audience that understands that probably far better than most people in the world. We've seen it, haven't we? I've seen big old storm come through, winds batter a house for hour and hour, hurricane force wind, hour after hour after hour, and when it's all done, house is still there. Maybe you got to fix a few gutters. Maybe there's some fence down, but the house essentially is there. It stood. We've seen that, and we've seen the opposite too, haven't we? We've seen a big storm come through, and on some home site, all that's left is a pile of rubble that they're going to bring a backhoe in, and they're just going to scrape it away. It didn't withstand the storm. Listen, if you want your house to withstand the storm, you've got to build for the storm. Can I say that again? Did you catch that? If we want our house to withstand the storm, we have to build for the storm. So if you look back at the parable, verse 24, 25, that's exactly what the wise man does. Why? Why does he dig down and find the rock and lay his foundation there? Why does he do that? Because he's thinking about the storm. Foolish man, he's building for the sunny day. He isn't thinking about the storm when he builds his house. And even our little kids know how that turns out, right? The storm came and the foolish man's house went, oh, y'all could do it with me, splat, right? So, as we ponder our own building, we need to think about that. We need to think about the storms because, brothers and sisters, the storms are coming. There will be financial storms that devastate us. Lost jobs, huge unexpected expenses, debt, bankruptcy, it happens. There will be marital storms. Spouses will cheat. Trust will be broken. At times, families will be ripped apart. Children will grow up and walk away from Jesus and devastate their parents. People we love and care about will be afflicted with terrible diseases that cause suffering and that linger and then take life. The storms are coming. The interesting thing is that not everybody reacts to the storms in the same way. Have y'all noticed that? I've watched people I love and care about be devastated by a storm, just flooded over with grief and sorrow. And when it was over, their faith was gone. They walked away from Jesus. Have you ever seen someone do that? And oddly enough, I've seen exactly the opposite happen, haven't you? I've seen people go through a terrible ordeal. And as they did, they held on to Jesus more than ever before. And when it was over, when the storm had passed, their faith was stronger than when they started. How do you account for that? How do you account for two opposite reactions to the storm? You know what Jesus would say? He'd say, come out here. Look under their house. What did they build on? If we want our house to withstand the storm, brothers and sisters, we have to build for the storm. Now, I have to tell you that if I'm going to be fair with Matthew 7, I'm forced to say that there may be something else or maybe better put, something more that Jesus has in mind when he talks about the storm. And I at least want to put this on the table this morning. You know, throughout this final piece of the sermon, have you noticed that Jesus keeps pointing us to the end? So when he talked about the two ways, he talked about the broad way that leads somewhere to destruction and the narrow way that leads to life. And then in verse 19, when he's talking about the tree, he talked about the fire that consumes the bad tree. And then he got down to verses 20 to 23, and he talks about that day that's coming when the lawless are going to be told to depart. And then we get to this very last parable, the last piece of the sermon, and he talks about this storm that exposes every man for what he really is. And when I begin to set that in its context, it makes me wonder, if that doesn't happen at any other time, when the trumpet sounds and Jesus comes back and you and I are judged, brothers and sisters, the veneers will be gone. And we will stand before God as we really are. And I can't help but wonder, perhaps the message of the parable is that it is the one who acts on the words of Jesus, the one who does what he said. It is the man who lives the obedient life, who is ready for that last great storm. And so when I look at that context, I'm forced to acknowledge that maybe that's what Jesus has in mind. I will leave it to your study and pondering for you to reach your own conclusion about that. But the storms are coming, and wise men build for them. John Stott, in his excellent book on the Sermon on the Mount, right at this place, makes a really useful observation that I want to share with you. He said, the question is not whether we say nice, polite, orthodox, enthusiastic things about Jesus, or whether we hear his words, listening and studying, pondering and memorizing until our minds are stuffed with his teaching, but whether we do what we say and whether we do what we know. In other words, listen to this. Whether the lordship of Jesus, which we profess, is one of life's major realities. I really like that. I like that because it actually carries us over to the last two verses of the chapter, because Matthew adds a little bit after the sermon. He adds a little bit that focuses our heart on the teacher. And I want you to think about that as we wrap up this morning. Look at verse 28. The text says, when Jesus had finished these words, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one having authority and not as their scribes. It is interesting that as Jesus finishes the sermon, Matthew, I think, points us to what is really important about it. And it's not what Jesus said. Think about that. What is truly important about the Sermon on the Mount is not what he taught in it. What's truly important is that Jesus taught it. Brother Earnhardt made this observation, and I really like it. He said, at last, we are not so much confronted with the compelling and challenging message of this great sermon as we are with the person of the preacher himself. That's right. And that's what the audience seems to get. When he finishes, they're talking about the teacher. Who is this guy? He's not like everyone else. They even seem to get what it is. He teaches with authority. I mean, they get it. So here's my question. Do we get it? You know, if someone came along and tried to argue with us that Jesus was just a great teacher, we would protest, right? Even if they were willing to say he was a great moral teacher, the moral ethic he shared is perhaps one of the greatest ever taught. Even if they would say, we would say what? That's not enough. Jesus is so much more than that. But do we really believe that? It's interesting that in Luke's telling of the story, he begins with a question in Luke 6 and verse 46. He says, why do you call me Lord, Lord? You know the rest of it? And do not do what I say. You see it? Sometimes, brothers and sisters, our reaction to the teaching of Jesus should make us wonder what we really believe about Jesus. When we quibble over his instructions, when we take his words and twist them to fit what we already wanted to do anyway, kind of makes you wonder what we really believe about him. Because if he is Lord, then there is only one right response to what he said. The one right response is humble obedience to whatever he said. It's not what's in the sermon, folks. It's who preached it. That's the thing that matters. Which, oddly enough, brings us back to the point of the parable, doesn't it? Verse 25. It is the person who acts on the words of Jesus, who is wise, who is building on a solid foundation, who is building a life that will endure and one that will stand in the face of the last great storm. And so may God help us build for the storm. Which does raise the question this morning about how we are building. Maybe talking all of this about all of this has helped each of us ponder our own life. And I wonder if someone sitting in the crowd today isn't saying, I've been building on the sand. And maybe you already know you're not ready for the storm. Maybe you've been there. In his grace and mercy, we have an opportunity to do something about that today. The great teacher is eager to receive us back. It's time to quit building a house that's only going to collapse and begin today building on the rock. We want to help you do that, whether you need to come to Jesus for the first time or you need to come back to him because you've been busy playing in the sand. It's time to get back to the rock. However we can help you, want to do that today. You let us know by making your way to the front right now. While we stand.